Appreciate so much that introduction. Brethren, I've got to tell you, I'm truly humbled to be here today. This lectureship is one that for the 2 years we spent at the Memphis School of Preaching was one that was built up and praised as one of the greatest in the brotherhood. The privilege to be here and speak on this lectureship is definitely a humbling experience. But I also feel it necessary to tell you how much we appreciate the aid that you sent to us to support us during our 2 years there. From a letter being sent and an interview on the phone, you brethren decided to support us, and we were never able to come and tell you how much we appreciate that. And I do not feel that it would do you justice to not take an opportunity to tell you thank you from the bottom of our hearts, beyond what words exist to be able to comprehend. Thank you so much. You know, I've got to say, while we were at the Memphis School of Preaching, and I know you are familiar with Brother Keith Mosier, sitting in class with him was an amazing experience. I know you've had the privilege to hear him preach and to teach here before, but sitting in a class with him was an amazing experience. And the only reason I bring that up was to say this. It seemed like every time that we were writing papers for his class, whenever I chose whatever my paper would be written, he would look at me and start laughing. Because somehow it seemed like I'd always choose a difficult passage to write about. Well, when I got a message back around the 1st of May or end of April, somewhere in that area, that someone needed to come and fill in for the lectureship here, sure, I'd love to do it. Let me send you your assignment, and then I see it's Daniel 7. Well, nothing's changed. Daniel chapter 7, I loved so much being able to study this material. I don't know how many books I had the ability to pour through to be able to try to gain ideas and pull this information together. But being able to study through that, you began to see that there are so many different opinions and theories and thoughts and running rampant in different directions. At times, it gets to be a little bit laborsome. Because you look at this, you say that this is supposed to be a Bible scholar on this hand who is taking this information and running this direction with it, but then you go and find another Bible scholar on this hand who's running somewhere completely different. And to be quite honest, sometimes it can get daunting. But see, then we've got to look for that note of what we can find where this is one who's making sense. This is one who we esteem, who is we know is a scholar, who has made a lifetime out of preaching truth, and has taken and taken it upon himself to explain this in a manner of which you really can't argue with it. Well, that's what we've tried to do when I was putting this manuscript together. A number of the details we will not be able to look into deeply. Take a look at the information that is in the book. As Brother Hayes said last night, none of these ideas are original with him. These ideas aren't original with me. You'll see there are a lot of notations in there as to where this information came from. So take it upon yourself to take the opportunity to read through this chapter. Not only read through this chapter, but try to get some understanding of the elements that are used within. Chronologically, part of the assignment that was given was to explain the chronological order as it relates to Daniel chapter 7. Well, understanding that the first four chapters of Daniel run in chronological order, you have Babylon taking over the kingdom and taking all those off into captivity in chapter 1, and Daniel and his friends going with them. In chapter 2, you have that dream that Nebuchadnezzar had of that great statue and the explanation of it. Well, understanding coming into chapters 3 and 4, looking at the end of Nebuchadnezzar's reign. Well, right in the middle of chapter 4, or at the end of chapter 4, we see a break in the timeline. You see, now we need to jump to chapter 7, because that's where chapter 7 would fall. We're looking at a time in the first year of Belshazzar's reign. If you look at Daniel chapter 7 and verse 1, we understand that this is the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon. We try to understand the historical background. Looking at chapter 8, we understand that that's the third year of his reign. Look, chapters 5 and 6 fall afterward. So just quickly re-explain so we don't get confused, because looking at all those numbers bouncing around, that can become confusing quite quickly. We're looking at chapters 1 through 4, chronological order. Chapters 7 and 8 followed by 5 and 6. Of course, those matters will be discussed in those other sections as well as how the chronological order pertains to the other chapters within the book of Daniel. But the question comes, why then is this recording out of chronological order? Wouldn't it have been so much easier just to start with page one and go to the end and understand that everything happens just in a timeline? Well, there are two sections within this book. We understand that within this book there is the historical section. This information that deals with the Gentile world powers. And then there's the Jewish section, which is known as that prophetic writing. But then right in the middle we have chapter 7. Chapter 7 serving as, if you will, a connecting link of these two sections. The plausible explanation that I have seen for this portion of the book being written in a separate language is that the author was describing the frailty of human kingdoms. This may very well have been written in that Aramaic language or that other language, that other language that the book was written in, because that was the language that would have been understood by those rulers who were overthrown. You see, if you're trying to get that man's attention and say, "Dear King, there is something you need to be warned of. This is the information that you need to see." Would it not make more sense to write it in a language he would understand? You know, how often do we pick up the phone and try to call someone, and we try to call to get help with, let's go IT-wise. My computer's not working. And I've got to get on the phone and call and get help, and the next thing you know, that phone call is routed overseas to who knows where, and someone on the other end of that phone picks up that phone and starts jabbering, and you can't understand a word they're saying. Now, how are you supposed to fix my problem if I can't understand you? Therefore, the same reasoning would lie behind why that other language was used, that Aramaic language, that language of the court, if you would, there in that Babylonian land. Other prophets aimed their words more directly at the people of God. True, the Jewish section, that prophetic section, Daniel would also have done the same. But he wrote as much for the heathen rulers as he did for his own people. You know, there's an idea going around. It's heavily going around in our brotherhood in a lot of places. And it's very unfortunate. It is the idea saying that those in the Gentile world were not amenable to God. Yet here's Daniel proving that to be false. Here's Daniel saying, "No, Gentile king, you are amenable to God. You do have to answer to him. You had better learn his will and add it to your life and be obedient to it." Arguments as to the explanation to the language, they're numerous. As we mentioned in the outset, that many of these arguments, they go in so many different directions. But as I was reading through some materials, I came across Brother Ira Stancliffe's commentary on Daniel. And I had to say, the words that he used fit this quite well. He said, "Many of these arguments are designed more for the exhibition of mental powers of the scholars than for the explanation of the Word of God." You see, brethren, we need to take care of the Word of God. James said in chapter 3 and verse 1 that there be not many masters. There be not many teachers, folks. Why? Because knowing this, we shall receive the greater condemnation. We had better take care with God's Word. Take that mental power, take that ego and get rid of it. Put it aside. You know, my wife and I were talking about that commercial that was out when we were children. When the commercial would come on and the toaster would pop up and one of the children would walk in and grab the waffle out of it, and another would come in and say, "Let go my ego." Folks, we got to let go our egos. We've got to put them in the back seat and let God's Word rule number one in our lives. How else, brethren, can we expect to follow along with that exhortation of Jude 3 when he talked about that word which was once delivered unto the saints? Within the book of Daniel, we see eight divisions. Now, we're going to go through these as in a timely manner as we can. I've got to be quite honest with you. I usually preach with about a half a sheet of notes, and now today I've got five. So I don't know how in the world we're going to get through all this material. other than to say, I hope you've got your seatbelts buckled up, because we may just have to put the pedal to the floor and go flying. The first division we see, verses 1 and 2. We're not going to take the time to read through the text and discuss it as well. I would leave it up to you to read through that text, and hopefully you have read through chapter 7 before arriving this morning. But for verses 1 and 2, we see the kingdom of the time. Historically, we need to understand what was going on with the kingdom of the time. It is very likely that, and there are a number of reasons to point this direction, that it had been 20 years had passed since, some 20 years passed since the death of Nebuchadnezzar. So we're looking at some 20 years between sometime after chapter 4 and the beginning of chapter 7. Nabonidus had become ill shortly after Cyrus had begun his uprising. He became so ill that, according to Thompson in a pulpit commentary, explained it as such that he became so ill that he couldn't be seen publicly. And not being able to be seen publicly, he no longer dealt with the business of the nation. And by not dealing with the business of the nation, guess what? If you don't take care of it, things are going to start getting behind. So he places his son Belshazzar up as a co-regent, ruling at the same time along with him. In other words, he was a co-regent king. It was this first year in which we see Daniel recording verse 1. In the first year of his reign, the first year of Belshazzar as a co-regent. Also in verse 1, we began to see God revealing himself to Daniel. If you notice, he says in chapter 1 or in verse 1, he had a dream and visions of his head upon his bed. There were so many different ways throughout the Old Testament in which God chose to reveal himself. Hebrews chapter 1, the writer of Hebrews also gave us that description when he said, God who in sundry times and in divers manners, what's he saying? In all the times and in many different fashions did he reveal himself. How? Unto the fathers by the prophets. But he hath in these last days spoken unto us by his Son, whom he hath appointed heir over all things. This divine revelation was received while Daniel slept. This is what we might call a dream. You know, sometimes we like dreaming. Sometimes we wake up and we think, you know, I remember parts of that dream. That was a pretty good dream. Other times we wake up and sweat, scared to death of some of the things that our imaginations become up with. But see, how many times, brethren, do we think about the dreams that we've had and be able to remember them in intricate detail? Yet Daniel does just that. He takes that dream and he records, not in complete detail, because if you'll notice in verse 2, it was the sum of the matters. I can only imagine what Daniel must have beheld as he laid there on his bed, sleeping, and having these visions going through his mind. What was it that he saw? There must have been so much more to this account and these episodes as they transverse across his mind. What did he see? What much more was there as he sat and recorded the sum or the essential details of this matter? Then he begins to set the scene. He sets us a scene and he paints us a picture of him of standing on the shore of the great sea and looking out upon that sea and seeing the waves in turmoil as the winds from every direction, every corner of the earth are coming together and converging all at once. You know, there's one thing in this area that we're not unfamiliar with. We've seen the devastations that tornadoes cause. We understand that when things are going on up in the skies and we look up and we see the winds crossing each other and we begin to see those clouds starting to swirl, we know that torture's coming somewhere. I can only imagine what Daniel must have beheld as he looked out across these waters and saw the waves erupting in turmoil. You see, this is descriptive of the many nations around the world. The many nations around the world who would be in an uproar of self-conflict and fighting. The next section, verses 3 through 8, is one that gets met with a lot of explanation going in many different directions. In verses 3 through 8, Daniel begins to relay these four beasts which he beholds. and relaying them to those kingdoms, representing world powers that currently were with the subsequent powers to come, the four beasts are brought into his view. Four different creatures with one unique characteristic. As we look out throughout the animal kingdom, every single creature has the same characteristic. They all operate off of instinct. And it is an instinct of survival. You ever seen, and watching these shows about the television shows about the big cats in Africa and other parts of the world, have you ever seen that little deer run out to that lion and say, okay, I'm next? No. You see them running for their lives. You see them doing everything they can to survive. You see, these creatures are creatures of instinct. They all contain a ferocity, a bloodthirst, and no respect of other creatures, only a desire to survive, to kill and eat. You see, all of these four creatures are equivalent to the world power, those world powers discussed, and possessing an intense hunger to gain lands and grow with a ferocious greed. That first creature which he beholds, in verse 4 he says the first was like a lion. I almost have to wonder, as Daniel looked at this creature, and he says it's like a lion, what was it that he saw? That the thing that would come to his mind to describe this creature would resemble a lion. Not only a lion, but a lion with eagle's wings on his back. How often, folks, do we look at archaeological findings and find pictures of these lions with eagle's wings depicted as the symbol of a nation? It was readily found in Babylonian archaeological finds that it was used to describe that very nation. You know, do we not use this same thing? We have that eagle perched. That eagle's sense of pride and gracefulness being perched up as a symbol of our own nation. You see, using creatures as symbols for nations is nothing new. But as we look at this lion, we understand that he was warlike. As the king of beasts, the lion brings into attention strength and courage. The lion, as fear-inspiring as he is, though, his range is short. He does not have the ability to go outside of certain bounds. His range is enclosed. But with that addition of the eagle's wings, his range is then opened up. He is turned into an item of speed rather than one who is just going to pounce and overpower. When conquering nations, brethren, the Babylonians were senseless. They had no regard for other people. If we were to try to explain that, the type of ways that they would go in and take over nations, I'd be willing to bet half of us may get up and leave. Because they were ruthless. They were bloodthirsty. By the time of Nebuchadnezzar's death, he had been made to stand on two feet, though. If you would, the feathers of those wings plucked. As the realization that the God of heaven is in control. And at that time, that power ceased to be aggressive. And then the next creature comes into view. In verse 5, we are given a creature that is likened to a bear. The graceful movements of the lion have gone. Now they're being replaced with a lumbering, cantering of a great bear. A bear whose ferocity when hungry or when protecting their young is well known to be as some of the most dangerous in the animal kingdom. You know, I had a friend of mine when Brother Stockton was mentioning a while ago that I spent several years in the fire service. Several of the guys on the fire department that I worked with would go off into Colorado elk hunting. One of them came back hurt once. Had to take quite a bit of time off. Because as he was walking through the mountains, he turned a corner and turned around to face a big brown bear on her back legs. He didn't know which way to go. He turned to run and fell in a hole. And that hole probably saved his life. You see, brethren, because when we consider how dangerous that creature is, It is awe-inspiring. It should strike fear in our hearts. I don't know about you, but that's the one place I do not want to find myself, is between a mother bear and her cubs. But see, there was one thing missing from this creature. Those wings that were attached to the lion, which also were attached to the leopard to follow. You see, this allusion is being made to the Medes and the Persians. Looking at this creature rising up on one side, the Medes being the more prominent, at least at one time and at first. But that representing that nation of Medo-Persia as they came in and took over the Babylonian kingdom. We look at those three ribs that are hanging out of his mouth, and here we go again, scholars going crazy. It would be unbelievable to try to write down the different ideas that people have explaining those three ribs. But as I read through this text, I see Daniel merely mentioning those three ribs and nothing more. He didn't focus on them. So here's where I must be careful not to become weighed down in the details. Because as long as I understand that that creature was representing that Medo-Persian Empire, those three ribs are inconsequential at the time. Then we come to verse 6 and the leopard. As we think about this of the big cat kingdom, we understand that the leopard moves with grace. He moves with speed and agility. He could far outweigh taking down the lion and capturing his prey because that's the way his body is built. But not only is that body built for speed, but we have in addition to it having those four wings added to his back. You see, this creature very well represents Alexander the Great in the kingdom of Greece. Because over a period of about 10 years, under Alexander the Great's rule and his leadership, he conquered all of the known world that he felt was worth taking. And then we're brought to that final beast in verses 7 and 8. With Daniel's ability to look at these beasts and relate that one was like a lion, one was like a bear, and one was like a leopard, my imagination begins running wild with what he must have seen, that he could not assign an animal designation to it. He simply says it's a terrible beast. It is a great beast. It is dreadful. Yeah, that was the Roman Empire. We understand by looking at that timeline and relating this just like we do to that statue of Nebuchadnezzar's dream, that the Babylonian Empire gave way to the Medes and Persians giving way to the Grecian Empire falling to the Romans. But there was something specific about that dreadful and terrible beast that caught Daniel's attention. As that beast came out and those 10 horns were on its head, our attention then turns to those 10 horns. You know, we mentioned a moment ago, sometimes you can get weighed down with details. But as I look at this, at verse 8, Daniel said, "I considered the horns." That tells me there must be some importance played upon that feature of this creature. He considered the horns. That is, he looked until another sprang up from among them. It sprang up among the others, starting from the same source. It started from the same source as those other horns. It sprang up among them as a smaller horn at first, but yet subsequently it grew and became a symbol of power, great power. In the growth of that horn, three of the others were plucked up by its roots. And then he notices the eyes and mouth, and a mouth speaking great, boastful things. Of the numerous commentators which can be found discussing these subjects, Brother Rex Turner was the one that I came across that actually gave explanation as to how all of these things applied. If following along with the conclusions to which he drew, this timeline with those 10 horns would begin with that Roman ruler of Pompey. And going from Pompey up through Vespasian. You see, Vespasian became the emperor of Rome, commanding the Roman forces in Egypt and Palestine. And he proved himself to be one of the greatest Roman leaders they ever had. You know, we look at that warning of destruction, of the coming destruction of Jerusalem in Matthew chapter 24, in the first half of that chapter. And we understand that during the reign of Herod Agrippa, a great amount of unrest became prevalent in the area. And an uprising in AD 66, when that fighting erupted between the Jews and the Romans were run out of the area of Judea by Roman rebels, Rome decided that the Jews of Caesarea were no longer entitled to citizenship. And Vespasian was then sent by Nero to go reconquer that land. As he was preparing to mount his attack, Nero took his own life. And in taking his life, Vespasian pulled back, because there were other things that needed to be done. Now, as to those 10 horns, there are a number who say that 11th horn, that little horn that sprung up boasting great things, that little horn would apply to Domitian or Nero, but I couldn't find any evidence to substantiate that claim. While other classes drone on about premillennialism, that Daniel's prophecies are still in the future, but then according to that second chance philosophy, this would all have to be interpreted as literal. So at some point, for this to come true, we're all going to have to stand on that seashore. We're all going to have to see those waves, tumultuous waves, and we're all going to have to see those beasts come out of that sea. Of the plausible possibilities, here's the undeniable fact. That fourth creature applied to the Roman kingdom. It applied to that Roman empire. And then Daniel's vision continues on. In verses 9 through 12, there's a judgment scene set up of that boastful beast. Remember that horn, that 11th horn that came growing up out of the rest, uprooting three as it came. That boastful horn, speaking great things. There is a judgment scene being set up. In verses 9 and 10, we see the scene being set of the setting of the bar of judgment and the Ancient of Days now coming on scene. A lot of people look at that and will say, who's the Ancient of Days? Who could it be other than Jehovah God? The Ancient of Days speaking of His eternal nature. The Ancient of Days speaking of His wisdom, His knowledge. Three times in this chapter, this designation is used, alluding to that eternal existence. And He is brought before us with hair of pure wool. As we look around, one of the things that I've always enjoyed in life was finding folks who had, let's just say they've been on the earth a while, and listening to the stories that they could tell. I love those stories. We used to have an older gentleman there at Maybank who was very influential in that congregation being established. And I used to love sitting out with him as he fed his horses and listening to his stories of wartime and the times that he met his wife and growing through his children's lives. Because he had that wisdom, that knowledge that we could learn from. Moses recorded in Leviticus 19 that thou shalt rise up in verse 32 before the hoary head, the gray head, and honor the face of the old man. Fear God, for I am the Lord. See, as we look at this picture of the Ancient of Days and that hair of pure wool, we beget that realization that the Almighty Jehovah God exudes purity. He is pure. There is no impurity found within Him. John recorded in 1 John 1 and verse 5 that this then is the message which we have heard from Him and declare unto you that God is light. Guess what? In Him is no darkness at all. He is the illustration, the portrait of purity, and He has come to sit in judgment of this boastful beast. As we see this picture before us, that we are given the picture of a throne with flames coming from it, with fire coming from it. How often throughout history is fire used for a purification? As metals are cleaned and they are sent into the fires and they are molten down to have the impurities burned out from them. How many of you have a ring, maybe a wedding ring made of gold? How would you like to look down at that ring one day and see a little speck of aluminum in it? That wouldn't make you very happy, would it? Because that metal's not pure. You see, here we have those fires and flames exuding from the throne, burning out impurities so that impurity can't even be in its presence. Out of time already. We haven't even got started good. Let's see if we can wrap this up quickly. Verses 13 and 14 are the coronation of the king. The judgment scene is past, and the Son of Man is seen coming on the clouds. Now, I want you to notice something about this. Look with me at verse 13. I saw in the night visions, behold, one like the Son of Man came with the clouds from the Ancient of Days to rest upon the earth. I got a question for you. How come I'm not getting some of the craziest looks I've ever seen in my life? Correct me on that. Do not let someone stand in this pulpit and say something that the Bible doesn't say. He said that he saw him come with the clouds of heaven and come to the Ancient of Days. Folks, this is a picture of the ascension before the day of Pentecost, which is recorded in Acts chapter 1 and verses 9 and 11, when he arose within the clouds going to heaven. There's nothing in this text that says he came to earth. Verses 15 through 27, we have that angel's explanation giving to Daniel, describing those four kingdoms. But we also notice that David was bewildered. His interest was in those ten horns. I'd have to leave it to your time and judgment to take the time to look at the explanations given behind those ten horns and understand why this preacher also agrees with that information that Brother Rex Turner brought out of who those rulers are. Daniel's conclusion is brought to us in verse 28. Daniel says, "Hitherto is the end of the matter. As for me, Daniel, my cogitations much troubled me, I can only imagine. And my countenance changed in me, but I kept the matter in my heart." Why, Daniel? Why did you keep the matter in your heart? Because as he brings this section to a conclusion, the fact of the matter is, no matter what men may think, do, or say, God's got it under control. And we ought to leave it in his hands. Thank you for your time.